A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us one that landed differently. Not a question, exactly. A realization. Let me read it. The episode about daydreams, in which I shared my recurrent daydreams of doing specific jobs, which I gather puts me in the minority of people whose daydreams aren't about relationships, was interesting and immediately made me think about everything everywhere all at once. As a huge fan of movies and literature that explore our relationship with reality, this was mandatory viewing, but I admit, I wasn't immediately enamored by it. It took watching it a second time, and then a third, to realize that the tragedy could also be read as emancipation. That our unlived lives aren't dead ends, but maybe exist as parallel outcomes in a quantum sense. But the tragedy of paths not walked haunts the movie. Herman shared some powerful thoughts, backed by science, as he's wont to do, about how the intensity of our daydreams ebbs and flows as the desires they try to communicate are actioned or ignored. You interpreted my prompt as evidence that I had made some life choices to please others. I think that's fair. And we've talked about how one of the most common regrets in those nearing the end of their lives is that they lived a life true to others and not themselves. The thought I ended up with was, what if one develops the awareness later than they might have liked, and realizes that some of their priors were responses to expectations and efforts to please others? I believe it's never too late to course correct, and there's an imperative to seize that mental clarity whenever it manifests. Let's talk about the path to do exactly that, a roadmap for those who have realized too much of their lives was spent people-pleasing or following a roadmap they'd never have chosen, and they want the rest of their path to be guided by their own autonomy. On learning the habit of walking a path by road and learning to tread your own way with confidence and pride. So today we're building that roadmap, not from theory, but from the science of daydreams, the philosophy of parallel lives, and the psychology of latent life autonomy.
The thing that jumps out at me first, and this is where I want to start because it's the diagnostic clue, is that Daniel's daydreams are about specific jobs, not relationships. That puts him in the minority. The research on daydream content shows most people's spontaneous daydreams center on relationships, social interactions, loved ones. His don't. That's not a quirk, it's a signal.
Say more about why that distinction matters, because I think a lot of people hear daydream and assume it's all the same stuff. Fantasies, escapism, mental fluff.
That assumption is exactly why most people ignore their daydreams. They treat them like mental static. But daydreams are mental simulations. The psychology literature describes them as rehearsals of possible futures, the brain running scenarios, testing outcomes, exploring selves you might become. Think of it like a flight simulator. A pilot doesn't climb into the simulator because they're bored. They're testing maneuvers, practicing responses, building muscle memory for situations they haven't encountered yet. Your daydreams are doing the same thing for your life. When a daydream recurs, it's because the simulation hasn't been resolved. The gap between the current self and the simulated self is still open, and the content of the daydream tells you which gap.
So the content is diagnostic.
If most people daydream about relationships, it's because most people's unresolved simulations are social, connection, belonging. Daniel's simulations are occupational, jobs, roles. That points to a gap in autonomy, the first pillar of self-determination theory. Autonomy, competence, relatedness. He's been trading autonomy for relatedness, and the psyche is filing a protest.
So the daydream is the psyche's version of a picket line.
Well, yes. That's the image. It's not a distraction. It's not escapism. It's the part of you that knows what you actually want, refusing to be quiet. And the intensity ebbs and flows based on whether you're listening or ignoring.
You mentioned this in the earlier episode. The intensity dynamic. Walk me through the mechanism again. I want to understand the actual psychology of why it gets louder when you ignore it.
Think of it like a smoke detector. When the battery is low, it chirps. If you ignore the chirp, it doesn't stop. It keeps chirping at intervals. If you take the battery out, the chirping stops, but the underlying problem remains. The daydream is the chirp. When a desire is ignored, the daydream intensifies. The brain turns up the volume because the message isn't getting through. When you start actioning the desire, even in small ways, the intensity fades. Not because the desire disappeared, but because the simulation has been acknowledged. The gap is closing. The brain doesn't need to scream anymore.
So the volume knob is controlled by attention.
By action, specifically. Attention is the first step, but action is what turns the knob down. And here's the fascinating part. The action doesn't have to be dramatic. You don't have to quit your job to become a woodworker. You just have to do something that says to the psyche, message received. Sign up for a weekend workshop. Watch a tutorial. Buy a piece of wood and a chisel. The smallest action can reduce the intensity because it closes the loop. The simulation ran, the signal was sent, the signal was acknowledged. Daniel described exactly this pattern. He notices the daydreams recur, he notices they're about specific jobs, and he noticed something shift when we named the people-pleasing pattern. That's the mechanism in real time. The naming itself is a form of actioning. It acknowledges the signal.
Which brings us to the movie, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Daniel watched it 3 times before the reframe clicked. The tragedy became emancipation.
I love that he needed 3 viewings. That's not slow. That's the movie doing its work. The first viewing, you're overwhelmed by the spectacle. The second, you feel the weight of all those unlived lives. Evelyn as a kung fu master, a singer, a chef, a woman with hot dogs for fingers, every choice she didn't make, rendered as a parallel universe she can see but can't inhabit. It's devastating. The tragedy of paths not walked. The third viewing is where you see what the Daniels are actually doing. The bagel, Jobu Tupaki's everything bagel with everything on it. That's nihilism. When you can see every possible path, every choice becomes meaningless. Why commit to anything if everything is possible? The bagel is the trap.
And the googly eyes.
The googly eyes. Evelyn's reclamation. She sticks them on everything. On her husband, on her enemies, on the bagel itself. It's absurd, it's playful, and it's the exact opposite of nihilism. It's choosing to see meaning in the specific thing in front of you. Not because it's the best possible thing in all possible universes, but because you chose it freely.
The googly eye says, I see you, I choose you, and that choice is what makes it matter.
That's the emancipation Daniel is talking about. The multiverse isn't a catalog of failures, paths you didn't take, lives you didn't live. It's evidence that you have agency. Every branch exists because a choice was made. The tragedy isn't that you can't walk every path. The tragedy is walking a path you didn't choose.
This is where I think the movie does something really subtle that a lot of people miss. The Kung Fu universe, Evelyn, the one where she's this incredible martial artist, that's not presented as a better life. It's glamorous, it's exciting, but it's also lonely. She's estranged from joy in that universe too. The successful parallel lives aren't actually upgrades, they're just different.
That's crucial. The movie isn't saying you should have chosen differently and your life would be better. It's saying you could have chosen differently and that life would have its own problems, its own losses, its own bagels. The grass isn't greener in the parallel universe. The grass is just different grass. The point isn't to find the perfect universe. The point is to choose the one you're in. And that's where Bronnie Ware's work lands like a freight train.
Let's put that on the table. The number one regret.
Bronnie Ware spent 8 years as a palliative care nurse. She documented the regrets of the dying. The top regret, number one, above working too much, above losing touch with friends, above not expressing feelings, was this. I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. Those are the words of people at the end, looking back. And the word that kills me is courage, not opportunity, not resources, courage. They knew what they wanted. They didn't act.
That word choice is devastating. It's not that they didn't know. It's not that they lacked options. They lacked the courage to choose themselves over others' expectations.
And courage is a funny thing, because we tend to think of it as a fixed trait. You're either courageous or you're not. But courage is a practice. It's a muscle. Every time you make a small autonomous choice, Every time you say no, I don't want that, or actually, I'd prefer this, you're doing a courage rep. The people in Ware's study never built the muscle. They deferred the reps until there were no more reps to do.
Daniel's awareness is early relative to that endpoint.
That's the reframe. Realizing you've been people-pleasing feels like a loss, like you've wasted years, decades. But awareness isn't the problem. Awareness is the solution arriving. The people in Ware's study gained awareness when it was too late to act on it. Daniel has it now. That's not a tragedy. That's a head start.
The late awareness paradox.
That's what I'd call it. The feeling of, I figured this out too late, is itself a cognitive distortion. The research on autonomy shows that the capacity for autonomous choice isn't age-dependent. It's skill-dependent. You can build that skill at any point. The awareness is the first rep.
So let's build the skill. Daniel asked for a roadmap. 4 steps, I think. You and I talked about this.
4 steps. And I want to be clear, this isn't a career change plan. This isn't quit your job tomorrow. This is a protocol for testing signals and building autonomy incrementally.
Step 1. Audit your daydreams.
Not as fantasies to dismiss. As data, write them down. What jobs recur? Be specific. Is it teaching? Building things? Running something? Working alone? What do they have in common? Are they about autonomy? Being your own boss? Creativity? Making something from nothing? Solitude? Control over your environment? Impact? Seeing the result of your work? The common thread is the real desire. The specific job is just the costume it's wearing. Daniel's daydreams might be about being a carpenter or a coder or a writer, but the underlying need might be making things with visible results and nobody looking over my shoulder. That's the signal. The job title is noise.
I'd add, track the intensity. Rate each daydream on a scale of 1 to 10. How vivid is it? How often does it recur? How much emotional charge does it carry? That gives you a hierarchy. Some signals are louder than others.
Good. And I'd add one more layer to the audit, track the context. When do these daydreams show up? Is it during meetings? After conversations with a specific person? On Sunday evenings before the work week starts? The context is additional data. It tells you what's triggering the simulation. If the carpenter daydream only shows up after interactions with your micromanaging boss, that's telling you something very specific about what you're starving for.
Step 2. Identify the expected path you're diverging from. Who set that expectation? Parent? Partner? Culture? Peer group? Name it. Not to blame. To map the terrain. You can't navigate around an obstacle you won't acknowledge exists.
This is uncomfortable work. Most people-pleasers have spent decades not naming the source of the expectation, because naming it'd force a confrontation. But you don't have to confront anyone yet. You just have to see it clearly. I became a lawyer because my father expected it. I stayed in this town because my partner wouldn't move. I chose this career because it was prestigious in my community. Write it down. Look at it.
I think there's a subtlety here worth pulling out. Sometimes the expectation isn't from a specific person. Sometimes it's ambient. It's the air you breathed growing up. People like us do jobs like this. This is what success looks like. It's not a parent saying, be a doctor. It's a whole ecosystem that never even presented other options as legitimate.
Yes. The diffuse expectation is in some ways harder to identify because there's no villain. There's no one to point at. It's just the water you were swimming in. And that's why the audit matters. You're not building a case against anyone. You're just noticing the water.
The sloth approach to reckoning. Slow, deliberate, no sudden movements.
That's actually not a bad way to frame it. The point is clarity, not speed.
Step 3 is where it gets practical. Run a small bet on one daydream.
This is the critical step, not a career change, a low-stakes experiment. Take a class, shadow someone for a day, build a side project, volunteer. The goal isn't to succeed or to pivot. The goal is to action the daydream enough to see what happens to its intensity. If the intensity fades, if the daydream stops recurring or loses its charge, that means it was a signal and the signal was received. The psyche was saying, pay attention to this, and you did. If the intensity increases, if the daydream gets louder and more vivid, that means it's a genuine desire, not just a neglected signal. It's telling you more of this, this is real.
So the small bet is diagnostic. It doesn't commit you to anything except information.
And here's the thing. Most people never run the experiment. They either suppress the daydream or they blow up their life to chase it. The small bet is the middle path. It's the scientific method applied to desire.
Can we make this concrete? Give me an example of what a small bet actually looks like for someone who's been in a corporate job for 15 years and keeps daydreaming about. I don't know. Opening a bakery.
Perfect example. The blow up your life approach is quit the corporate job, sign a lease on a commercial kitchen, take out a loan, and hope it works. The small bet approach, bake every weekend for 3 months, sell at a farmer's market, take a single pastry course, offer to stage at a local bakery on Saturday mornings. Total cost, maybe a few $100s and some early weekend alarms. The information you get is real. Do you actually like the work, or do you like the idea of the work? Does the daydream intensify or fade? You'll know within weeks, and you haven't burned anything down.
And if it turns out you hate waking up at 4 a.m. to proof dough, you've learned something invaluable for the price of a few lost Saturdays.
That's the diagnostic working perfectly. The daydream said bakery, but the underlying need might have been creative work with tangible outputs, or autonomy over your schedule, or working with your hands. The small bet reveals the distinction.
Step 4. Build a regret-proofing practice.
This is borrowed directly from Ware's framework, a weekly check-in. Simple question. If I were on my deathbed, would I be proud of this week's choices? Not, did I achieve everything I wanted? Not, am I on the perfect path? Just, did I choose this week, or did this week choose me? The practice works because it shortens the feedback loop. Ware's patients were looking back over decades. A week is manageable. You can course correct next week. You can notice patterns. 3 weeks in a row, I said yes to things I wanted to say no to. What's going on?
That's a mindfulness practice dressed up as accountability.
It is. And mindfulness is exactly what Daniel's describing, seizing mental clarity whenever it manifests. The weekly check-in is a scheduled moment of clarity. You don't wait for it to arrive spontaneously. You build a container for it.
I practice something similar, though mine is more horizontal.
You mean napping.
I mean contemplative rest. But yes, often horizontal. The point is the pause, the space between stimulus and response. People-pleasing is automatic. You say yes before you've even registered the question. Building autonomy means inserting a gap. Even 3 seconds. Let me think about that. That's a revolutionary sentence for someone who spent a lifetime people-pleasing.
The clinical side of me wants to add something here. People-pleasing isn't a personality flaw. It's a survival strategy. At some point, it worked. It kept you safe, it earned approval, it avoided conflict. The problem is, when the strategy outlives the threat, you're still running the people-pleasing program in an environment where the cost is no longer worth the benefit.
So the roadmap isn't about becoming a different person. It's about retiring a strategy that's past its expiration date.
That's a much kinder framing than, I've been living wrong. You weren't living wrong, you were living adaptively. Now the adaptation needs an update.
I want to pause on that word, adaptation, because I think it reframes the whole journey. You're not fixing a broken self. You're updating an operating system that served you well in one environment, but is glitching in another.
And the glitch is the daydream. The glitch is the data. That's why step one is the audit. You're reading the error log. The system is telling you exactly what's wrong. Most people just click dismiss on the error message for decades.
Let's go back to the movie for a minute, because I think the quantum reframe Daniel landed on is the emotional engine of this whole thing.
The parallel universe is as emancipation, not tragedy.
Right. The surface reading of everything everywhere all at once is, look at all these amazing lives Evelyn could have lived. The kung fu master, the singer, the woman who stayed with Waymond in a different way. And the bane is that she can see them but can't have them. The path is not walked. But the deeper reading, the one Daniel got to on the third viewing, is that every one of those parallel lives exists because Evelyn made choices. The multiverse isn't a museum of missed opportunities. It's a map of agency. Every branch is evidence that she had the power to choose, and the ending is her choosing, freely, the life she already has, not because she's trapped in it, because she sees it now. She chooses Waymond. She chooses joy. She chooses the laundromat, but freely.
And that's the model for Daniel's roadmap. The goal isn't to undo the past. The past choices, the ones made to please others, are parallel branches. They exist. They inform the present. They're not wasted. The goal is to choose the next branch with full awareness. Evelyn doesn't get a do-over. She doesn't become the Kung Fu Master. She integrates the Kung Fu Master's skills into her laundromat life. She fights with kindness because she's seen every version of herself and chosen this one.
The googly eye on the bagel.
The googly eye on the bagel. Nihilism says nothing matters because everything is possible. Emancipation says this matters because I chose it.
So for Daniel, or anyone in this position, the parallel universes aren't the jobs you didn't take. They're the evidence that you can choose differently starting now.
And here's the thing about autonomy that most people get wrong. It's not just making your own choices, it's owning them with. Daniel used the word pride. Competence and pride. That's the end point of the roadmap. Self-determination theory identifies three basic psychological needs: autonomy, competence, and relatedness. They're not optional. They're needs, like food and water for the psyche. People pleasers sacrifice autonomy to preserve relatedness. They trade one need for another. The trade works for a while, but the deficit accumulates. The daydreams are the first symptom. The regret is the terminal diagnosis.
So the roadmap rebuilds all three. Autonomy through the small bets. Competence through actually doing the thing, even in miniature. Relatedness through what? Because if you stop people-pleasing, some relationships will strain.
That's the hard part. Some relationships were built on the people-pleasing. When you stop, the relationship wobbles. But relatedness doesn't mean everyone likes you. It means authentic connection. The roadmap trades quantity of approval for quality of connection. Some people won't like the autonomous you. The ones who stay will actually know you.
That's a pruning, not a loss.
It's a pruning, and it hurts. But the alternative is the deathbed regret.
I think there's a fun fact buried in here that you'll appreciate. The phrase pruning, in this context, it's actually borrowed from neuroscience. Synaptic pruning. The brain literally prunes away neural connections that aren't being used to make the ones that are used stronger. You're not losing capacity. You're reallocating resources.
And it's not just a metaphor. When you stop investing energy in relationships built on people-pleasing, you free up emotional and cognitive resources for relationships built on authenticity. The pruning isn't net loss. It's optimization.
Let's pull this into four actionable insights. For Daniel, for anyone listening who recognized themselves in this prompt.
Jugotti.
1. Your daydreams aren't distractions. They're your psyche's most honest communication. Listen to them as data, not noise. Write them down. Track their intensity. Look for the common thread underneath the specific job titles.
2. The regret of living for others is the most common deathbed regret, but awareness is early relative to that endpoint. If you're feeling, I figured this out too late, you didn't. The people in Ware's study figured it out when they had weeks left. You have years, decades. That's not a tragedy. That's a gift.
3. The roadmap isn't a career change overnight. It's a series of small bets that test the daydream's intensity. Action it until the intensity fades, signal received, or intensifies, which means it's a genuine desire worth pursuing further. You're gathering information, not burning your life down.
4. Reframe the past. The paths not walked aren't dead ends. They're parallel universes that inform your present. You're not starting over. You're choosing the next branch with full awareness. The googly eye, not the bagel.
And that leaves us with an open question. What if the daydreams never fade? What if you run the small bet, you action a desire, and the intensity doesn't drop? It just keeps burning.
That's the question I've been sitting with. I think it means the desire isn't for a specific job at all. It's for a specific quality. Autonomy. Creativity. Impact. Mastery. The job was just the nearest available symbol for that quality. If the intensity persists across multiple experiments, the roadmap shifts from what job to how do I infuse this quality into my current life? Maybe you don't need to become a carpenter. Maybe you need to make things with your hands and see visible results. You can do that on weekends. Maybe you don't need to run a company. Maybe you need autonomy over your domain. You can negotiate that in your current role. The persistent daydream is telling you what quality you're starved for. The specific job is just the most legible container.
The daydream as compass, not map.
Compass, not map. It points. It doesn't prescribe the route.
I want to sit with that image for a second, because I think it's the most important reframe in this entire conversation. Most people treat their daydreams as maps, as literal instructions. I keep daydreaming about being a baker, so I should be a baker. But a compass doesn't tell you where the destination is. It just tells you which direction you're facing, and which direction you need to go. North might be creative work with visible results. The bakery is just one town you could end up in on the way north.
And that reframe takes so much pressure off. You're not failing if you don't become the specific thing you daydreamed about. You're succeeding if you move in the direction the compass is pointing. Even 5 degrees. Even a single step.
Daniel's awareness is the gift here. The roadmap is a starting point. The real work is the daily practice, the weekly check-in, the small bets, the 3-second pause before the automatic yes. Choosing your own path with confidence and pride, as he put it, that's not a destination, it's a practice.
If you're listening and this resonated, if you've been people-pleasing and you just realized it, or you've known for years and haven't acted, share this episode with someone who might need permission to course correct. The deathbed regret is common because we don't talk about it while there's still time. Let's talk about it.
Send us your weird prompts. We read everyone, even the ones that make us confront our own unlived lives, especially those.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
Go put some googly eyes on something.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.